The 1996 Zen Sun Symposium presents Session 222, Confessions of a Mormon Episcopalian, by Jeff Needle, Miles Jacoby.
First thing, I'm Leonard Wald, and I will introduce the person who is going to give the I'll introduce both of them, the person who is going to give the main paper and the person who is going to be the respondent. The paper itself will be given by Jeff Needle. I've known him for some time. He is a Jew and an Episcopalian at the present time, although I know that he's been through many different religions, and he knows quite a bit about many religions. He is a member of our study group down in San Diego, and he is going to give quite a bit about his own history himself, so I won't give very much information on that. He calls himself an ecclesiastical gadabout, and I know that to be at least partially true. And I think I'll leave it at that. That's probably sufficient for you, since you're going to give your history yourself.
Good morning. Nice to see everybody. I want to say, first of all, that my talk was written last night. I generally don't even talk from notes. I usually just work off the cuff. And so when Miles Jacoby, the responder, called me a few weeks ago that you called? And said, gee, I wish you'd send me a copy of your paper, I almost laughed and said, ha, I wish somebody would send me a copy of my paper so I'll know what I'm going to be saying. Anyway, I did get it done last night, and so my talk will be unscripted, and his response will be equally unprepared and unscripted, but I'm sure it will be very enlightening. I've already heard some very, very good talks here at Sunstone. This is my second Sunstone to attend, and everywhere you go, you hear good people saying a lot of good things. And I can remember 30 years ago in a little church in New York City, a little Seventh-day Adventist church, I stood up in the pulpit for the first time and gave my first sermon ever. I was 18 entire years old at the time. And everybody who attended that sermon was very encouraged, because they knew I could only get better. And I don't know if that's happened. It's been nearly 30 years. But when I sit and listen to some people, the session just before this, Alan, you were there, was a very good presentation on geography and the flow of religions. You have a tendency to sit there and say to yourself, that was pretty good. Can you do better than that? And the only way I can describe how I feel is to tell you about a circus owner who lost his lion tamer. He advertised, and a young man and a young woman showed up the same day for their tryouts. He took them down to the lion's den. There was the lion snarling ferociously, sitting in a corner. He turned to the two and said, which of you would like to go first? And the young woman said, I don't mind, I'll go first. And she walked into the cage. The lion stood up, began walking toward the woman, when she began taking off all her clothes, right down to a mini bikini. The lion took one look at her, walked up to her, gave her a great big kiss right on the cheek, and went back silently to its corner. The circus owner turned to the young man and said, that was pretty good. Can you do better than that? And he answered, I don't know, but if you get that darn lion out of there, I'll sure as heck try. And that's how I feel. That's how I feel. I do have to tell you, no kissing allowed during this presentation, Aaron. I do have. Thank you. You did promise me you'd be here. Thank you for being here. I must tell you that this is my first visit to Salt Lake, and I am a little disappointed that I haven't run into more loonies than I have. But I guess, given, but I promised Leonard that I would tell this one story. I was walking back from the temple grounds on Wednesday, and this man who I guess I have a sign on me that only loonies can see that says, "Come talk to me. I'm interested in what you have to say." And he looked me right in the eye, and he said to me, you know why it's so hot here in Salt Lake? And I wanted to know. I thought this man had all the answers. And he said to me, because of all the seniors. And I looked at him, and I didn't want to say this. I said it as tactfully as I could, "Sir, aren't you a senior?" "Oh, yeah, this is just a joke that I tell people." But I didn't think it was that funny. But the light hadn't changed yet, and I decided I needed to pursue this. And I said, "Gee, you know, I had thought that it was all the Mormons around here that made this place so hot." And he looked at me and expletive deleted, said, "Those blankety-blank Mormons, blah, blah." Obviously, he wasn't one. And he complained about how the Mormons were taking over everything. And I said, hold on. The light had not yet changed. I said, "Hold on. You don't like the Mormons. You don't like the heat. Why do you live here?" And he said to me, "Well, it wasn't so bad until they showed up." By that time, the light had changed, and I decided a history lesson simply wasn't what was going to take place at that point. But he was very happy living here until you guys showed up. So just chill. Stop trying to take over, okay? Just very briefly, I was born in a Jewish home. I was bar mitzvahed at 13. I was circumcised at 8 days. I guess I should have said those things the other way around. It would have been a much more painful and difficult thing had they been reversed. At age 16, I was confronted with the claims of the gospel by a Baptist minister who was giving away free New Testaments. He knew exactly how to attract Jewish people. He had a big sign he was holding up. This was across from the public library downtown Manhattan, holding up a sign, "Free book to any Jew who will read it." He knew exactly how to get us to go over to that sign. And he gave it to me, insisted that if I didn't accept Jesus Christ as my Lord and Savior, when I crossed the street, if I was hit by a truck, I would go to hell and burn forever. And I was just, that's not what I had planned when I woke up that morning. I was just downtown for a visit. So I did it. 2 years later, I joined the Seventh-day Adventist Church. It was a very nice, smooth transition. Moved out here to California in 1974. Started looking around for something else and investigated Mormonism. Had two charming, threatening sisters come to my door, Mormon missionaries. One of them, and I will say, I'm a large person, so I can say this. She was a very, very large person. She was larger than I was, and I thought this would be why I would become a Mormon, because I was afraid of what she would do if I didn't. But I tired of the flip charts very quickly. Sent them on their way. Eventually joined the Episcopal Church, where I am now. Wanted to rediscover Mormonism some years ago. Went to the Deseret Bookstore in San Diego and said to the clerk, her name is Elizabeth, Erin, you know her. I said to her, and I've never met her before, I said, "I want someone who can tell me about Mormonism." And she said, "I'm going to give you a name and a phone number, and you call him." How many years ago was that? I don't remember. "And I want you to call him, and he'll tell you everything you need to know." So I called him, and he was very gracious. I went to his house, and he said, "Hold on." And he went upstairs to his study and brought down an armful of Sunstone magazines and said, "Everything you want to know about Mormonism is contained right in here. You just read these." So my first real exposure to Mormonism was Sunstone. Is it any wonder I'm as messed up as I am right now? All right, Confessions of a Mormon Episcopalian. This may seem a rather odd combination, but maybe it's not as odd as it may sound, because I find myself very intrigued. We're going to talk about it tomorrow in a panel discussion, what intrigues me about Mormonism. There are so many different things that are so attractive and other things that are not so attractive about both Mormonism and Anglicanism. And with you, the permission of these two gentlemen here who are, may I use the term Anglican and Episcopalian interchangeably, and you won't get upset. All right. See, no, I do have an accent, but it's a New York accent, and there's lots of Episcopalians there. I was trying to come up with a list of what I liked and disliked about both fellowships, and I chose a short list. Let me go through them. There's only five things that I want to play one against another to give you an idea of the tension that's going on in my own mind as an Episcopalian who loves Mormonism. Does that sound odd to anybody? It ought to. It doesn't sound odd to some of you. Gosh. First of all, one of the things about Anglicanism that I like so much is that it is essentially an open society. People can come in, and they're not compelled to subscribe to beliefs other than the fundamental beliefs of the creed, basically the Nicene Creed. Other than that, as can be testified by some Episcopal bishops, as a matter of fact, you can go just about any direction you want to and still not get thrown out of the Episcopal Church. There is an old story about a Jew and a Roman Catholic and an Episcopalian meeting in hell and discussing how they got there. The Jew indicated that he had been at a dinner party one night, and the hostess served some ham. He tasted the ham, and before he knew it, he was down that slippery slope, and he ended up in hell. The Roman Catholic said, "Interesting, I have a similar experience. Pre-Vatican II, I was at a dinner party. The hostess served some rump roast, which you should never eat if you subscribe to the idea you are what you eat. Stay away from rump roast." He said, "It was Friday. I shouldn't have eaten the meat, and I did. I slid right into hell." The Episcopalian said, "Amazing, I have a similar story. I was at a dinner party, and I ate the whole meal with the salad fork." There isn't a real strong religious impetus to this thing, the open society. Now, my perception of Mormonism is that this is not that. You cannot come into Mormonism with a broad spectrum of ideas. It's basically a closed society, as demonstrated by many of the activities in Mormonism, which are closed. I can't go into the temple unless I have a forged temple recommend. I am not supposed to partake of sacrament. All sorts of things that are closed off to outsiders. And on balance, I think I like the open society a lot better than the closed society. But with the open society comes a price that you pay. And this is point number two. It seems to me, and this is my perception, and I'm sure that Miles and later on probably Alan will tell me that I'm all wrong on this, because Anglicanism has such an openness about it, it seems to lack a sense of direction in the way it's going. I have spoken to people, many Episcopalians, and they don't have a sense of the direction in which the church is going. It's sort of like the quote in Alice in Wonderland. I think it was Humpty Dumpty that said to Alice, "If you don't know where you're going, any old road will do." And so Episcopalians tend to go off in all sorts of directions with the blessing of the church. Mormons that go off in all sorts of directions do not generally go with the blessing of the church. And this is my experience. But there is a clarity of direction. Mormons seem to know which way they're going. They're marching to Zion. And there is a sureness about that, and on balance, I think I like the certainty of the direction rather than the uncertainty of going just any old way. One of the things I like about Anglicanism is that it encourages independence of thought, and that would be number three. In fact, you could, in some circles, you can think just about anything you want to think, because Anglicanism simply says that the taking of the sacrament is what is important, not necessarily the depth or the direction of your belief. Anglicanism encourages independence. My perception is that Mormonism encourages obedience. Okay? I see a lot of nods. Did I hit that one on the head? Okay, good. Thank you, Aaron. I watched on TV last night the commencement address, President Bateman, is that his name, at BYU, and this solidified in my mind, this was true, the whole thing was, don't think for yourself. Let us do our thinking for you. And on balance, even though I'm wrong about 90% of the time, I think, Donna's saying no, I think I like the independence of thought better than the insistence on obedience. So we've got Anglicanism 2, Mormonism 1 in our scorecard right now. But with that independence, if you're keeping score, but with that independence comes the fourth point, that it is my sense, at least among the Episcopalians that I live with and worship with, there is a lack of a sense of identity. Episcopalians don't generally know who they are. There is a great historical tradition, but most Episcopalians don't seem to know what it is. I have taught classes on Anglican history, and there's a sense of surprise among most people that the early Americans, a lot of them were Anglican. It shouldn't be a surprise. That's where we came from, was England. I mean, they could have figured that out pretty easily. But there was a sense of surprise about the historicity of the faith. Whereas in Mormonism, I get a sense that Mormons have a very clear sense of where they come from, what their roots are. And on balance, I think I like the clarity of the roots, of the feeling of who you are. So now we're two and two, okay? The fifth and final point in this series, I don't know how to do this fifth point. Episcopalians, if you look on balance, have been described as a people who have their feet firmly planted in midair. When I try to discuss a corollary to that in Mormonism, I discover that I have no clue where LDS feet are planted. I don't know. If I walk down to Temple Square, I have a feeling they're in concrete. If I walk through the halls of Sunstone Symposium, I don't get that idea much at all. I have a feeling that feet are planted all over the place. And on balance, I like both ideas. So we end up with a tie score, in case you're interested. I decided that the only answer to my problem of what I was going to do was to start my own church. And so I announced the name of the church, and I'm going to upset somebody here because that we discussed in San Diego the name of this church. My name for the church would be the Episcomormian Church. And I am announcing the formation of this church right here. We've already had multiple ordinations on the internet of various and sundry people, one of which, by the way, is a member of the Manti group. He was ordained over his vigorous objections, but we don't care. One of our group in San Diego decided that Mormon Palian would be a better name for this group, but another one decided that sounded like a reptile or an amphibian. So again, on balance, perhaps Episcomormian Church is the best. Is the best thing. Now, how are you going to do this? Well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to follow the model that the Mormon Church has followed all along. And I'm going to share some observations about where I think Mormonism has gone, which will make the founding of this church very, very easy. In case you haven't noticed, Mormonism, and I'm going to look, not so much at the limited model of the Episcopal Church, but the larger model of the Catholic Church, with its biggest component being the Roman Catholic Church. I have been amazed that groups like Mormonism over the years have become organizationally nearly identical to the Roman Catholic Church. All right? And if you think about it, look at the parallels. The Roman Catholics have a pope, and he's a nice fellow. The Mormons have a president. He's apparently a fairly nice fellow, too, although I think I like the fellow before Howard Hunter a little better. I don't know why. But I suppose Gordon Hinckley's a nice fellow. Or instructions come from the top down. The pope has his advisors. The president has his advisors. The pope has his cardinals. The president has his 12 apostles. The pope has his bishops. The president has his 70s, et cetera, and so on. You can go right down the list functionally and organizationally, and you will see that there are so many correspondences that you wonder how this could have happened. After all, despite many protests to the contrary, I am of the opinion that if you were to ask the everyday Mormon, who is this great and abominable church, what would be the first answer to come out of anybody's mouth? It would be the Roman Catholics, of course. Folks on the internet have argued this and said, no, we're not talking about the Roman Catholics. But of course you are. And I thought, this was not the first time I've thought this. Other organizations like the Watchtower Bible and Tract Society have done exactly the same thing. They despise the Roman Catholics more than anybody, and yet organizationally they have also become equivalent. Top down, we are the channel of truth, we're going to tell you what to do, we're going to tell you what to believe. Now, how can this happen? How has it happened? I've come up with a theory based upon something I heard in a tape by a man who may be the greatest living philosopher that we have, and you probably didn't know it. His name is Mel Brooks. And he made a comment one day that we tend to become more and more like that which we despise. Now, this was a very interesting comment. His example was, you're walking along the street, you see an old man bent over and spitting, you make fun of him, and the next thing you know, you're old and you're bent over and spitting. So you have to be careful who you despise, who you don't like. You're going to become just like them. And I think this is what has become of both the Mormon Church, the Watchtower Society, without being fully conscious of this. And in fact, when you do have quarrels with another organization, the more you despise them, the more, in other ways, you become like them. It's an amazing phenomenon. That's why the Episcomormian Church, or Donisier, I wasn't going to bring this up, but the Mormon Palian Church, that's why it's going to be so easy. All we have to do is hate everybody. And we can bring it all together and form a very, very good body, a very good body. We do tend to become like that which we despise. I was never so amazed. And maybe it's just my naivete. And I may be, by, am I the only living subscriber to the church news? I don't know. In this room, does anybody else subscribe to it? I do. They have a new computer system, by the way. They sent me a notice in an envelope which said, your subscription expires. We must receive your check by November 11th in order to continue your subscription. And then another slip that said your subscription has expired. You're done. And I wondered about that and called them, and it turned out they have a new computer system that's got that all messed up. So if you're a subscriber, beware of your subscription. When I couldn't have been more surprised than when I saw on the cover the fellow from the Mormon church and the Catholic bishop sitting there nearly smooching on a rock. And I said, what in the world's going on here? They're doing something together. I don't know what's happening. I guess ecumenism is alive and well in Salt Lake City, which is very nice. But if you look at early Mormonism, you know, this sort of impetus of you're all wrong and we're the only ones that are right is bound to make some enemies. But the church, as it has grown, has just drifted into the very models of the churches that they so loudly rejected in the beginning. Fascinating. And I won't dwell on that very long. It's something to think about and to wonder where the church is headed next. To wonder where the church... I know where it's headed next. I got a call. I ordered one of these awful videos from the Church of Jesus Christ. It did arrive, and I noticed... It was the old. Do you remember the old logo? It wasn't that long ago, the old church logo. At the end of the film, it came up, and I swear, it said, the Crutch of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And I wasn't aware that they reset the type on these logos each time, so I called and got sent to what I consider church hell. I will tell you this. I will not even disguise this. Correlation. This is church hell. You get sent to correlation, you will not get a straight answer from anybody on anything. But anyway, they were going to do something, and this woman asked me, would you like missionaries to come visit? This was a young woman, and I said, yes, I would, the same day when you call me and tell me you have the priesthood. I will have the missionaries come and visit my home. All right. So what is going to be the structure of this new church? I wonder if this isn't going to be the church of the future. Here's what I envision, and I'm going to use the Mormon model because there's many more levels of bureaucracy than the Episcopalian model. The Episcopalian model, by the way, parish is the rough equivalent to a ward. And then the diocese would be the rough equivalent to a stake, I suppose, as close as you're going to get. Each parish has at least one priest, and generally a priest in charge called a rector, and nobody pays any attention to him or her, as you well know. And then you have the man or woman right above him is the bishop, and people pay even less attention to the bishop. And then above the bishop, there's simply a titular head known as the presiding bishop, who the bishops don't pay any attention to. So that sort of model isn't going to work in a church where I'm the boss. I mean, I'm going to move into a structure of this new church. My vision of my new church is where the highest order of ministry is the only place where we correspond to the Episcopal Church, and that is the people. That is men and women. Where every person, every man, every woman is a prophet, every man and woman is a priest, and every man and woman has met God face to face in one way or another. We won't have a prophet at the top after I leave office. We will have a president. We will have a president. And if you don't catch this, this is my vision of where I wish the Mormon Church were going. This is where I wish the Mormon Church were today. Our church will have a president, but this president, he or she, will preside and not provoke. He or she will guide but not goad, and bless but not bully. That's going to be the role of the president. The president will have counselors, and these are counselors who will truly counsel because the president will pay attention to what they say. Because in the abundance of wisdom, there's great wealth. And the more counselors we have, even each of us today, the better off we are. We will have a quorum of 12 apostles. Isn't that nice? I'm not quite sure how the apostolic succession is going to work here, but we'll work that out later. But they'll be apostles not because they've been appointed, but because they've been anointed. Because every one of these men or women will have walked the Damascus Road, will have worked out their trial, will not have grown up comfortably in a home where everything was spoon-fed, but they will be people who have had to decide for themselves what is true. And then at the depth of their despair, as they walked that road, they were suddenly blinded by the light and met Jesus Christ face to face. Those are the people that I want to be apostles, because they are the only ones who will ever understand what I have gone through, because they will have gone through the same thing. And we will also have 70s, and I don't have the slightest clue what the 70s are going to do. We're going to release them to do whatever they want to do. All right. So there's my structure of the church. We will be taking nominations for different offices later on today. We will also have a vigorous evangelistic movement, but it's going to be different than the evangelism in the Episcopal Church is almost non-existent. It consists of signs that say the Episcopal Church welcomes you. Are you all... In the Mormon Church, of course, evangelism is very much a part of the church, sending out the missionaries, and as an aside, sending these poor kids who have been put through about a 30-minute training session, I suppose, and then go out into the world and try to cope with people like me who have no intention to listen to what they have to say on flip charts but have real questions. Can I tell this story about my trip through the visitor center? I went through this thing here. I went through this thing, beautiful visitor center, and this young lady from Santa Barbara was giving us a tour, and there was an English family on the tour. We went into this room filled with stars and planets, and I didn't know what they were doing there. We were supposed to be getting this grand scene of eternity, and they shut off the lights, and there was some music from someplace coming. It was really spooky, and the planets started shining this way and that way, and here was the Earth. And then off in the distance, there was this orb going like this, boom, boom, boom. And I wondered what that was. So I said, deliberately loud enough for everybody in the room to hear it, "Is that Kolob?" And this sweet little girl from, she must have been 8 to all of 18 or 19, I guess that's the right age to be on a mission, she said, "I don't know. This is the first time that planet has come on since I've been giving those tours." The people from England looked around. Kolob? What in the world is a Kolob? We didn't go into it. Later on, there were some other funny things about it. But anyway, our evangelism is going to be different, and the model is going to be a story that I read in a magazine called The Living Church, which only two of you will know what that is. It is the unofficial house organ of the Episcopal Church. It is actually the National Enquirer of the Episcopal Church. Okay. The rector of my church calls it the living crotch because he thinks that they grab people by the gonads and squeeze until they repent. I'm not sure. And there was a wonderful article in there one day about a man, a priest, who was all burned out. And by the way, Episcopal priests can get married, so when I talk about his child, don't think this was a scandal. It wasn't. We have enough scandals to deal with without having to invent new ones. He talked about needing to spend some time, this was about 6 years ago, spending some time with his son. He had been so busy, so he planned a fishing trip. And they went out, and he and his son were going to camp, and what he really wanted to do was spend some time with his son. Well, they got to the campground. It began raining, and it didn't let up raining until they left. And they were disgusted. They were bitten over with mosquitoes. He was just so disgusted because they didn't catch a single fish while they were there because of the rain. And when he got back, he spoke to his bishop about his frustration, and the bishop said, "Wait a minute, your goal was to spend time with your son. Is that what you did?" And he said, "That's exactly what I did. But we didn't come home with any fish." And the bishop very wisely said, "That's why they call it fishing and not catching." You see? And ever since then, that's become a kind of model for evangelism. I believe Mormon evangelism is way too results-oriented. We weren't on this tour for 10 minutes before we were told about this comment card in which we were to check off a little box that said, "Yes, I want missionaries to come to my house to give me a Book of Mormon." And I thought, "Whoa, slow down. I just got here." And I didn't need a Book of Mormon, obviously, but these folks did from England. I believe that any kind of... Of course, we've done this very lighthearted today and tongue-in-cheek. But I think that no matter what organization you belong to, I'm an Episcopalian, most of you are Mormons, some of you are not anything. Well, no matter what we are, what labels we put on ourselves, we are all on a journey of some sort. And sometimes the organizations we belong to help us on that journey. Sometimes they try to keep us from going on a journey because we're not on the road that they think we ought to be on. But there isn't, I don't think there's really any organization or any council or any bishop or any priest or any stake president that can stop a person who feels led by the Holy Spirit to go in the direction that they want to go in. Sometimes you have to buck the organization. Sometimes the organization helps you. One of my years as a Seventh-day Adventist, I spent at a small, very strict school. Boy, you talk about rules. BYU has nothing on this school. In fact, at this school, this was in a little town of Wildwood, Georgia. I spent a year there. The men and the women were not permitted to talk to each other. Right? And I had a roommate who had a cousin going there. And when they crossed in the road in the afternoon, when he was going to his classroom and she was going to his, they were not allowed to acknowledge each other. Even though they were cousins. This was how strict and how awful it was. I wanted to go home after about 4 months just to visit, but there was a rule that you couldn't leave campus for 6 months once you got there. And I decided to appeal to the president of the college, and he told me right out, this was a big surprise, he said, "Brother Jeff," he said, "if the Lord wants you home, no set of rules, no organization, no board is going to be able to keep you here. If he has to, you won't even need an airline ticket. He'll just pick you up in his hand and whisk you back to New York if that's what he wants." And as it turned out, that's what he wanted. Now, it was less dramatic than that. I did take an airplane home, but that's how it all worked out. But the evangelism of the Episcopalian Church is going to be very simple. I'm going to go up to somebody, and I'm going to let them know that Jesus Christ has made a difference in my life. That's our evangelism. Jesus has made a difference in my life. And I'm happy about that difference. I'm happy about the way I've changed. I'm a happier person. I'm a freer person. I'm a saner person. Yes, I have been less sane than I am these days. And I'm going to meet people face to face. And I'm going to remember always that this journey that I'm on and that we're all on is a wonderful journey. But we should never lose sight of the fact that the purpose of the journey isn't always to reach the end, but it's to enjoy and live to the fullest the journey itself, because the joy of the quest is in the questing and not necessarily in the finding. I know none of you are going to join my church. I probably won't join it either. Because that'll take all the fun out of it, wouldn't it, if I don't have somebody to fight with. But I hope that just a few thoughts this morning about the Mormon Episcopalian standing in front of you here. What I've outlined is what I wish for your church, for my church, for everybody's church. A place where people can become fully people, where there are no lines drawn between black and white, between male and female. That when Paul announced that the gospel brings down these walls, that he was absolutely committed to that and knew what he was talking about. And I really hope that this church continues to grow and prosper and to grow in understanding and to mature and to change in those directions. Well, thank you very much.
Now, the respondent has an amazing biography. Biographical sketch here. His name is Miles Jacoby. Is that the correct pronunciation? Jacoby?
Jacoby.
Okay. I look down here and I find other pertinent information, which is fascinating. It says former administrator at the Brigham Young University, that he is a former member of a stake high council and a bishopric. Currently, on the other hand, and he has an M.A., from the Johns Hopkins University of Advanced International Studies, and he has a certificate in education for ministry from the St. Luke's School of Theology, Episcopal. The University of South, I don't know what that is. This is for 4-year M division level, taught by extension from the University for the South for lay people. And he is currently the convener of the Society of Chad, St. Mark's Episcopal Cathedral in Salt Lake. And the Society of St. Chad is a support group for Mormons and others in religious transition. That has to have a very interesting history behind. May I suggest that you give us a very short version of that history while you're up here? That's fascinating.
thanks. If we remember anything today, and I've had an interesting experience in talking with Jeff over the phone when I waited weeks and weeks and weeks and didn't see any paper, and I thought, well, gee, you know, maybe that's part of coming to the Sunstone Symposium, because I got a call last night. Oh, the night before last, from Jeff Silliman of Mount Olympus Presbyterian Church, saying, you're responding to my paper tomorrow. I hadn't even seen the paper yet. That was another thing. But one of the things that I hope that we take away from this is that I think it's kind of a part of the Episcopal ethos is that Episcopalians tend to have a sense of humor. I would add to that that you have to have a sense of humor if you're going to be an Episcopalian. It is definitely not a church for the squeamish. I can assure you of that. It is not. It is not for. And I'll pursue that a little bit more seriously as we develop some things. It is a place for what I call the spiritual adult, someone who can take their lumps as they walk through this particular journey as we go through our spiritual lives. A little bit about the Society of St. Chad. And I'm sorry that Leonard had a hard time reading what came out of my typewriter. I just want to mention, prior to speaking about St. Chad, there is a program that's taught by the University of the South, which is a very old Episcopal seminary, or old Episcopal university, and there's a seminary attached to that. It's fondly known as Swanee. It's in the middle of nowhere in Tennessee. And it has put together, probably having spent most of my life in adult religious education of one form or another, it's probably one of the best adult religious education programs I've come across. It's designed, and it was designed originally, for lay people, those people who are not particularly ready or can or on a path towards ordination, to get a serious theological education. It's something of a Master of Divinity level type work done by extension over a period of 4 years. It's as rigorous as you want it to be or as simple as you want it to be. But it has provided for me and for many other people a very good opportunity to have some in-depth theological education, if that's what they seek. Well, as far as the Society of St. Chad, when Jeff called, he said, now, you were at the Order of St. Chad, aren't you? And I said, well, no, we're not an Order of St. Chad. We're not a bunch of monks that hang out at the cathedral, as much as that little image kind of delights me from time to time and as monkish as my life can get. It's not what it is. The Society of St. Chad was actually formed, and we have a former convener here with us today, about 8 years ago, Alan? 1984. Oh, interesting year. By a former Latter-day Saint who is now an Episcopal priest. And the idea was to put together a support group, a genuine support group for people, specifically for Latter-day Saints that were in religious transition. And the ethos that was set down at the time was one that this was going to be a genuine support group and not be, you know, a forum for people to complain, merely to complain for the sake of complaining, but to assist people as if they come to a particular point in their life that they go through a spiritual change, a religious change. It took for its model the life of St. Chad, who in the 7th century, and I always get this wrong, and Alan corrects me all the time because I can't remember the number. In the 7th century, Chad was a bishop in England, and Christianity came to England very early. In fact, Christianity, the Christian faith, arrived before Roman administration. So there's a tale in and of itself. Faith precedes the administration. And Chad had been ordained to his particular bishopric. He and his brother were the founders of a monastery. And he had been ordained to his bishopric according to Celtic ritual, Celtic rite. And when the Roman administrator showed up, they said, oh, well, you know, we're going to clean things up around here, and you weren't ordained according to Roman rite, so we don't want you to be bishop anymore. To which Chad replied, that's good, I didn't want the job anyway. You know, I don't like it, I don't think I'm worthy of it. To which the Archbishop of Canterbury at the time threw up his hands and said, wow, you're just the kind of guy we want to be a bishop. So he immediately turns around and reordains him. And you normally see pictures of St. Chad in the literature, the Celtic bishops had this charming custom of walking where they went. They did not have Roman administration, nor did they have some of the trappings that went along with Roman imperialism that came into the Roman Catholic Church. So the Celtic bishops had this tradition of walking wherever they went. And Chad said, okay, I'll be ordained according to Roman orders, but I'm not going to ride a chariot or ride a litter chair or a horse. And he continued to walk. And the story is that the Archbishop of Canterbury forcibly had him lifted up and put on a horse so that he would ride around. But the ethos is that it is possible, it is to recognize that in our spiritual journeys in life, it is possible to come to a point where you may have to, where the road is going to divide, and you may choose another road, and that is a normal part of a person's spiritual life, and to make that transition as easy as possible. And we genuinely try to do that at the Society of St. Chad. So enough for that. We're not people wearing robes. I enjoyed what Jeff had to say a great deal because he focuses in on those things that make make both the Episcopal Church in the United States, which is a part of the Worldwide Anglican Communion, and the Mormon Church, kind of what I call kind of eccentric type of organizations. They're rather unique in their histories and in the kind of people that they tend to attract. There's various variations on this dinner party story. Episcopalians are very familiar with these. And there is a mini truth that are spoken in jest. This does say something about what I call Episcopal sensibility. We like to talk about that the Episcopal Church is part of the worldwide Anglican Communion, and Anglicanism grew out, was a part of the Reformation, but in fact it's not really fully Roman Catholic and it's not really fully Protestant, and we like to use this term, so this is the via media, that we try to follow a balance between the two. And from a doctrinal and a theological point of view, that has a lot to recommend for it. But to a great extent, people are held together, I think, in the religious communities that they choose to join by a certain sensibility, by just what happens there. In the Episcopal Church, you know, we like Gothic cathedrals. We like to build this Gothic thing. And we like to use English terms. We call our priests rectors or vicars, depending on where their money comes from. And I've never quite figured out why Provo has a rector. I'm not really sure. I'll discuss that with Alan later. We don't have basements in our churches. We have undercrofts. We don't have janitors. We call them sextons. And we don't have traffic cops. We have vergers, you know, the ushers. We call them vergers and that kind of thing. We have this certain English sensibility, and that probably, as much as the doctrinal things, tend to be what hold Episcopalians together. We have a particular form of worship that has been handed down in a remarkable piece of literature that was put together by Thomas Cranmer called the Book of Common Prayer, which was a compilation of all the various, at that particular time, at the time of the Reformation, liturgical worship that was in the Roman Catholic Church. When you went to Mass, there were all kinds of little books and things, and you would skip around, and there were different liturgies depending on which city you were in. And Cranmer compiled these into a particular book that really is a remarkable religious document that's had a great deal of influence on the American, both in the English and the American languages. Hemingway, for example, claims that whenever he wrote, he had at least two books at hand. One was the King James Version of the Bible. We don't normally associate that with Hemingway, but anyone who loves language would recognize that. And another was the Book of Common Prayer. And the similarity there is this, that the Book of Common Prayer is renowned for its economy of language. And, of course, that's what we remember Hemingway for, saying very little in very few words. So there's a certain sensibility there. So in this dinner party story, the one I always heard, I've heard this particular version, and the one I heard, and I kind of like it a little bit better because it reflects more of the sensibility. The Catholic priest says, yes, I ate meat. I had roast beef on Friday. And the Jewish rabbi says, well, I had a ham sandwich. And the Episcopalian says, well, all I know is I showed up in church wearing a leisure suit with white shoes, and suddenly I found myself here. There's just a certain style and a way of doing things, and that's probably just as important as the doctrinal stuff. This is a particular sensibility. Actually, this concept of a sensibility is deeper than you think. There's a remarkable work that was done by Richard Niebuhr in the 1920s called The Social Sources of Denominationalism. And Niebuhr, in observing the multiplication of denominations in the United States, he found that looking for doctrinal things really was not enough, because despite how Mormonism likes to present the Christian faith, the Christian faith is actually fairly unified in terms of belief. There are certain core doctrines that just about any Christian of any stripe can adhere to. There are, however, because of the complexity of Western history, of the history of our culture, there have arisen, because of social and economic and political and even geographic and linguistic reasons, different ways which Christians have chosen to express their particular faith. So there is, in fact, one faith, but there are various, in fact, numerous ways to express it. Well, Niebuhr, looking at this, just basically said, you know, that this doctrinal thing just doesn't work. And so he began to explore, in a very important work, the social sources of denominationalism. And that's where some of this humor comes from. In fact, he talks about the English sensibilities and the Englishness of those people who gravitated or who remained in the Episcopal Church in the United States after the American Revolution. The immigrant churches, such as the Lutherans, the congregational churches, such as the Presbyterians, that in fact these grew out of historical and geographic and cultural reasons. There is something in that regard I would like to mention about Mormon sensibility. And it's interesting that Jeff mentioned this, that one of the things he likes about Mormonism is, in fact, it does have a sense of direction and order. And it's very true. For those of us who, at different parts, who reached a particular junction in our lives that we chose to leave and separate ourselves from that organization, it was actually that order, that sense of direction that told us, well, I can't deal with all this direction I'm getting. I can't deal with that anymore. But I have to admit that, and this is something that is not in my curriculum vitae, as Leonard read it, that I'm a product of the LDS missionary system. I was converted at age 18. Went on a mission 18 months later, came back, got married in the temple, went to BYU, and, you know, just the whole nine yards. And I have had to reflect a great deal on my own spiritual life as to why I chose that path. And I began to recognize what I call, and this is what attracted me, it's what I call the particular genius of Mormonism. And there is a genius there. Because of its sense of order, it brings into the lives of day-to-day Christians, just, you know, people sitting in the pews, what we call in historical Christianity a spiritual discipline or spiritual direction. It brings about a particular style of spirituality, a personal rule of life. There are, in the Christian tradition, many different styles of spirituality. You may have heard of Benedictine spirituality or Franciscan spirituality or Jesuit spirituality, although some people would say Jesuits have no spirituality whatsoever. There is a spirituality in that intellectual intensity. Mormonism brings into people's lives a certain rule of life. And there's a great genius that comes to that, and that brought a great deal into my particular life at a certain time. It's unfortunate that rule of life is a one-size-fits-all kind of shirt that turns into a hair shirt, and once you grow to a certain point, it just doesn't fit anymore, or that may happen to you in your life. And it's unfortunate that Mormonism can't really deal with that in a healthy way. But when you have an organization that claims to be the one and only true and living church on the face of the earth, by definition, you're going to have that particular problem. Jeff is very accurate, I think, in his portrayal of the evolution of an organization, that you become what you hate. This happens in the lives of people. You become what you hate just as much as you become what you love. We see this at the Society of St. Chad all the time, and this is a particular warning that I give to people as I see them struggling with it, because it was something I had to say to myself at a particular time. When I was going through the transition, I had to say, listen, I'm not going to be a bitter, angry ex-Mormon. I'm not going to become a professional anti-Mormon of what I call the hysterical anti-Mormon school, because that's not good for me spiritually. That just is not a spiritually edifying thing. But many people, as they go through that particular transition, they follow this particular phenomenon. If Mormonism is a photograph, if I'm holding up right here a color photograph, their lives become the negative of that photograph. Anything the Mormons do, I'm going to do the exact opposite. whether it's right for me or the good thing for me or not. People who go through a divorce tend to do this. Here's my ex-wife, and I do have an ex-wife, and her life is completely the exact opposite of everything that I ask her to do in terms of the children, whether it's right or not. Okay? We become what we hate in the same way that we become what we love. It's the two things are just as powerful. And Mormonism has, in fact, grown into a particular organization that is very, very similar. Very similar to a very rigid top-down hierarchy as we see in the Roman Catholic Church. And in fact, I would even submit that they are even more Roman than the Romans. The Romans, since Vatican II, have made great strides in softening up their positions. They do still see themselves as the church holding the sacraments necessary for salvation, but they allow a very much of a greater dialogue than they did in years past. There is a particular interesting history, and I'm just going to wrap up with this, that I wish all Mormons and all Episcopalians could be aware of, because I think it's quite amusing. I think Episcopalians are, in fact, some of the first people to establish certain traditions that exist within Mormonism, and I'll expand upon that. Until the work of Michael Quinn on magic and Mormonism, there was probably one of the biggest bugaboos that Mormon historians dealt with was the so-called 1826 Bainbridge trial, when Joseph Smith was brought in, tried, and convicted for being a public disturbance because he was looking into a stone. But there had been reports of that all over the place for years and years and years. One of the earliest published records of that in Mormon scholarship was in Fawn Brody's No Man Knows My History.